Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 27th of January 1924, the Times finds little reason to mourn dead Lenin. But first, some of the other items that have caught my attention this week. On Tuesday, the government lost a vote of confidence. Well, technically, it was the debate on the King's speech, but in British constitutional terms, it amounts to much the same thing. James Ramsay MacDonald, leader of the Labour Party, was then appointed Prime Minister. Britain had its first Labour government. But it does not have a majority in Parliament, and it will not be able to act as it wishes. One of the very first announcements of the new Labour government, a wish upon which it could act, is that the barriers at the entrance of Downing Street are to come down. From what I can divine, they were put up in 1920 out of concerns over Irish Republican Army terrorism during the Irish War of Independence. One of the legal problems with this is that Downing Street, in theory, was just another road which anyone has the right to walk down. Barriers reappeared, this time on a rather more permanent basis, in the late 1980s, again in response to an IRA terror campaign. The IRA campaign went away, but the barriers did not. The railway strike threatened last week has materialised. Very few services are running. To be frank, I'm surprised there are any at all. In the heyday of unions, they had all sorts of means, fair and foul, to ensure the compliance of their members. I saw this in Thursday's edition in an article about how London is coping with the strike. No complaints in regard to delivery have been received by the dairy companies. The cry of Milku. Well, it says Milku, but I think it's pronounced Milko. The cry of Milko is heard as usual in the residential roads of the suburbs, and the housewife, as a rule, finds the milk bottle or can outside the door for the early breakfast. I wonder what a milk can might be. Talking of railways, I saw this in Thursday's edition. What seems to have been an attempt at train wrecking occurred near Glasgow early this morning. When a goods train was approaching Cleddon's Bridge near Lenzie, the engine struck an obstruction on the line. It was found that several large stones from the coping of the adjoining wall were on the track. I had always thought this sort of carry-on was much more recent, but I was wrong and need frequent reminding of the fact. Mind you, it could be related to the current strike. In real life, the week of preparation for this episode saw heavy rain cause the Thames to burst its banks in several places. Things are no different in 1924, with floods reported in any number of places upstream of Teddington. Clergymen know all about inundations, and it would appear there are other strings to their bows. This is from Friday the 24th of January. There was a sequel at Liverpool Police Court today to a practical joke played by an Isle of Man clergyman in sending a bogus telegram to the Bishop of Sodder-on-Man, Dr. James Denton Thompson, who was thereby induced to make a fruitless journey to Liverpool on the day when he should have moved the second reading of the Church Enabling Bill in the Legislative Council of the Isle of Man. The Reverend Walter James Caron, curate of St. Matthew's Douglas, pleaded guilty to aiding and abetting Alice Mary Winston, assistant manageress of a London cafe, to utter a forged telegram purporting to be written by the Right Honourable Stanley Baldwin, Prime Minister, to Denton Thompson, Lord Bishop of Sodder-on-Man, on December the 3rd. The result was that the Bishop postponed an important engagement and proceeded to Liverpool. He learned at the Adelphi Hotel that the telegram was unauthorised and that Mr. Baldwin had left Liverpool. He, the curate, was fined £10 and ordered to pay 25 guineas costs. My kind of cleric. A few weeks ago, I think it was in the World 100 Years Ago special, I mentioned the Rhineland separatist movement. I suggested that its leaders were chancers, its followers criminals, and its backers the French. The British government has recently held an inquiry, and its conclusion is much the same. As mentioned earlier, This week brought the news that Lenin, dictator of the Soviet Union, had died. The Times has an article, they don't call it an obituary, outlining his life and times. This is from Wednesday, the 23rd of January. This extraordinary figure was first and foremost a professional revolutionary and conspirator. He had no other occupation. In and by revolution he lived. Authorship and the social and economic studies to which he devoted his time were to him but the means for collecting fuel for a world conflagration. The hope of that calamity haunted this coal dreamer from his school days. His is a striking instance of a purpose that from early youth marched unflinchingly towards a chosen goal, undisturbed by weariness or intellectual doubt, never halting at crime, knowing no compunction. The goal was the universal social revolution. The article goes on to mention how his elder brother was executed for his part in an assassination plot against Tsar Alexander III. Lenin joined the Social Democrats, later to become the Communist Party. On the subject of party organisation, we have this quote from Trotsky. "This man, with his habitual talent and energy, played the part of disorganiser of the party. Comrade Lenin made a mental review of the membership of the party and came to the conclusion that the iron hand needed for organisation belonged to him." And back to the author. "Lenin's idea was that the Central Committee should absolutely dominate every individual and every local group in the party." He became an exile, at various times living in London, Geneva and Krakow. At the outbreak of the war, he returned to Switzerland, where he carried on defeatist propaganda with the object of transforming the war between the nations into a revolutionary civil war within each nation. It then talks about the aftermath of the February Revolution and the establishment of the Provisional Government. After the failure of Kornilov's attempt in August, Kornilov was the commander-in-chief of the army, to re-establish law and order, the general demoralisation increased. The army went to pieces, and taking advantage of this disorganised host of armed men, to whom he promised immediate peace, Lenin effected a coup d'état on November 7, 1917. This time without any difficulty. This is not the place to describe in detail the terrible achievements of Bolshevism. But you're going to do it anyway, aren't you? Rightly so. The shameful peace with Germany. The plundering of the educated and propertied classes. How do you plunder educated classes? No matter. The long-continued terror, with its thousands of innocent victims, the communist experiment carried to the point of suppressing private trade and making practically all the adult population of the towns servants and slaves of the Soviet government. The Civil War, the creation and strengthening of the Red Army, the fights with border peoples, the Ukraine, with Kolchak and Denikin, leaders of the anti-communist or white forces in the Civil War. And with Poland, culminating in 1920 in the defeat of the White Armies and the conclusion of peace with Poland. Never in modern times has any great country passed through such a convulsion as that brought about by Lenin's implacable effort to establish communism in Russia and thence to spread it throughout the world. Message from Stalin, he says, "Hold my beer." In the light of these world-shaking events, Lenin's personality acquired an immense significance. He retained control. He was the directive force. He was, in effect, Bolshevism. It happened sometimes that after listening to a discussion of two conflicting motions in some meeting under his chairmanship, Lenin would dictate to the secretary, without troubling to argue his point, some third resolution entirely his own. The communist experiment brought Russia to economic ruin, famine, and barbarism. Under Soviet rule, the Russian people suffered unheard-of calamity. To Lenin, this mattered little. When the famine came in 1921, he remarked, with a scornful smile, "It's a trifle if 20 millions or so die." Other than what I learned at school, most of what I know about Lenin comes from Richard Pipes's The Russian Revolution. What is remarkable is how similar the Times' assessment from 1924 is to Pipes' assessment from 1991. They knew at the time what communism and communists were like. They're cracking on with the funeral arrangements. The embalmed body will lie for some time in a glass-lidded coffin on a low pedestal within a shallow grave in order to enable hundreds and thousands of people to come and take farewell of their leader. A pyramidal wooden mausoleum is being constructed provisionally, but later a more substantial monument will be erected. Embalmed bodies being placed inside pyramidal structures, eh? I wonder where they could have got that idea from. In preparation for this episode, I did actually look at some photographs of Lenin's mausoleum as it is now. And you have to say, it's shockingly bad. I mean, it's a terrible shape, it's poorly decorated, it's the wrong colour, it's in the wrong place. I mean, when I say wrong colour, it's more or less the same colour as the wall behind it, but not quite. So it doesn't really stand out. It's also shorter than the wall behind it, which makes it look rather unimpressive. As a symbol of Soviet communism, it works remarkably well. One person who is conspicuous by his absence is Trotsky. Some say he is in Moscow, others that he is in the Caucasus. Not that it matters, because it is not that he matters. Not anymore. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.